good afternoon now. It feels like it's good afternoon anyway. We're going to change focus. I'm really excited that we've been able to hear about these really wonderful innovations in many different parts of the world, and I know we've all learned things that we can take home to our own programs. I'm going to sort of take a somewhat different focus because, as we all know, disasters, war, and other adverse events are occurring with increasing frequency around the world. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the implications on maternal and child health, because women and children are always adversely affected disproportionately in these situations. So I'm going to tell you, so I have no relationships at the close. I'm going to quickly go over a little bit about Haiti, and very little bit, and the Haitian Health Foundation, so you have a context. And then I'm going to talk about what the events of the last 18 months have meant in terms of maternal and child health in Haiti. So in terms of Haiti, since we're all putting up our maternal mortality rates and our infant and newborn mortality rates, you can see that we have the highest ones presented so far this morning. And one of the difficulties in Haiti is that for some time now, before all of these disasters, some of these indicators have been worsening. So we know they're probably getting poorer now. And I'm not going to go through all of them. But the other thing is that Haiti is a fragile state with a very limited health infrastructure. So it has only 0.36 health professionals per 1,000 population. WHO recommends 2.5 for the very minimum. And just to put this in a context, a global context, you can see that the blue, that kind of turquoise blue line at the bottom, which kind of parallels the average for sub-Saharan Africa, is where Haiti is. So Haiti is really like sub-Saharan Africa, just located in a different hemisphere. The Haitian Health Foundation has been working for almost 25 years in the Grand Anse area of Haiti. It's founded on a public health program, and I just want to acknowledge my co-author, Betty Gabrian, who is sitting right here in the front, whose vision and foresight created this program. And so this is the foundation upon which all of the other interventions have been based. So we now cover a population of almost 200,000 people, 128,000 of whom are registered. And critically important to this process, and also something that Betty established, is a family registration system. So for those 128,000 people, we know who they are, we know where they live, and we track their health outcomes over time. And that was a foundation for looking at the impact of what happened during these disasters. So that just shows you we're way out at the very end of the tip of Haiti. The town is about a 35,000 population. It's the departmental seat. It's in a very mountainous region. It's also coastal areas. The Haitian Health Foundation programs are both in town, but primarily the public health programs serve the rural population. And so health posts go out to those communities. Just to give you an idea of the kinds of activities that we've been involved in and how they've grown over the years. So the focus really started out on child monitoring and maternal tetanus, and then has expanded over time as we gained skills as a program and as the health agents became more proficient at their work to provide some of the services that you've heard about in some of the other presentations. So I'm not going to go through that specifically, and including reaching out more now to adolescents, because we know how important young women are and young men to our future. And I want to also acknowledge Callie Kaplan, who is sitting up here next to Betty Gabrin, who has done a lot of work on the soccer program and its impact on adolescent birth rates. So the data sources that I'm mostly going to be talking about are the census, because that's how we know who's there, which happens every 5 years or so, and the FACT, which is a computerized public health information system, which is how we track the activities. Very important to this process is giving feedback to the community, so all of the information we collect goes back to people in those communities to make priorities and set decisions. So now I want to talk a little bit about each of these events as they happened. So everyone knows about the earthquake and what happened in Port-au-Prince, and I'm not going to talk about that. I think the story that most people don't know is what happened to all the people who left Port-au-Prince after the earthquake. So you can see that over 600,000 people left in the month, actually the first few days after the earthquake. And a good number of those people came out here to our area, which is that second big thick line coming out to the left. So that meant we had this tremendous influx of people. So that was one aspect of it. And this just gives you some sense of how crowded it was for people coming by boat, on foot, and in every possible way they could after the earthquake. And I have to say that HHF staff was there with the government helping triage people and making sure that those people who needed care got it. So we were 100 miles away from the epicenter, and all of our staff did survive, even those who were working or going to school in Port-au-Prince at the time. But all of them lost family members, and the range went from 0 to 22. So most of them, the average loss was 2 family members. Each family also took in at least 5 other family members who were coming back. So the tremendous stress that's put on families in this situation, I'm using our staff as an example, but all of the families in the area took in all these new household members, and these were families that in the mountains really didn't have much to begin with, so it was a tremendous strain. The housing damage wasn't extensive, but HHF has been helping build new houses. But it was a 20% increase in population. So for our small rural area, that meant the equivalent of 9 community health agents. HHF has also done a good job of employing people who came after the earthquake. So they've employed 10% of their workforce now is made up of migrants. Why did people leave? Well, the main reason is they lost their homes in Port-au-Prince. But again, as women were affected disproportionately, almost everybody was working in Port-au-Prince. That's why people go there. They have some source of income that they don't have in the rural areas. But women were much less likely to be reemployed. And students, males, were more likely to be in school than females when they returned to the rural area. We asked people when we did this was a census of the people who migrated, and we asked what would keep them there. And what would keep them there is employment, because that's why they go there in the first place, and education, because in Haiti, most education, most higher education is centralized in Port-au-Prince, so that's where people have to go. I wish I could tell you that some of those things are being addressed, but they're still not happening, so. And we're currently now looking at return migration because the infrastructure has not been developed to take care of these migrants. And so we estimate at this point that about half of those people have returned to Port-au-Prince, but they're probably living in tents because they have nowhere else to live. So what was the impact of this tremendous movement of people? Well, it obviously increased our service population considerably, which meant that we also saw an increase in pneumonia. We saw a decrease in vaccinations because there were so many children to take care of, and the sick ones got the attention first. We had, 6,000 new women of reproductive age and 1,500 children under 5. So at the same time, the staff was trying to take care of all their family members who had returned. They were also trying to take care of all these new people who had come to their communities and who needed their services. We also did a qualitative thing looking at breastfeeding practices because we knew that that was likely to have been disrupted for mothers who were in Port-au-Prince at the time of the earthquake. But amazingly enough, and I'm not going to go through the details of it, but I'm happy to tell you about it if you're interested, women continued breastfeeding at all costs because they knew that was the only way their infants were going to survive. Interviewing those women was a very difficult thing because they were telling their stories, and those stories were very difficult to hear. So we were just kind of getting some of this situation a little bit under control, and we knew that cholera was on its way, but it wasn't in our area yet when Hurricane Thomas hit. And that was in November, and this is just showing you what the Caribbean is like at this time of year, which is these are all the paths of major storms in 2010, and the one that circled is the one that hit our area. This is a picture, and I'm sorry for those of you in the back, but this picture, it's the same view, only one is the year before and the other one is during the hurricane. So there is a little tiny stream of water, a river, in the back of that upper picture, And that's what happened. So you can imagine the destruction and devastation that occurred to all of the crops in that area. So fortunately, loss of life was not that severe, but loss of homes was, and losing all of the food supply. So it also disrupted all forms of transportation, which slowed the cholera coming to our area. And the only thing we have to compare this to is some data from 1988 when Hurricane Gilbert hit, and similar destruction in terms of food and animals. And we did research with New York University looking at malnutrition over a five-year period of children under five. And the upper graph shows the mean weight for age by year. So what happened was the year after the hurricane, the weight dropped. So that's what that big drop is. So from 1988 to 1999, the weight dropped because of the lack of food. And what happened the following year was the mortality went up because all of those underweight children were now more likely to succumb to the illnesses they had. And we're expecting that we're going to see similar patterns after this and are doing everything we can to provide food and nutrition help. So anyway, so then we got to cholera. As you all know, Haitian art is quite a wonderful thing, and I like to use this picture not because I like what's in it, but because it represents Haitian view of the cholera epidemic. So this is the total as of August 31st, and you can see that there are different areas. So the area in the north is where the cholera outbreak started, and that's where there have been the most cases, and it's also the highest population base. We're clear out on the far end, and we actually have the highest mortality rate in the country. This is looking again through July in our area, and the way that cholera cases get counted is by those people who actually get to a facility, and we can talk a little bit about the problems with that. But this shows that the biggest peak, this is like November and December of last year. We don't have the data from November and December of this year yet, obviously, but this is again the rainy season, and we expect the cases to increase, and we hope the fatalities don't. The high mortality rate is really due to the fact that there were so many deaths early on, and it was about an 18% death rate in our area at the beginning. We were able to look at our census area so we could really look at what some of the things were that made a difference. And I just want to draw your attention to the variability in terms of the attack rate, which went from 1% to 4%, depending on which county you lived in, which commune you lived in. And then also that the fatality rate was extremely high in one area, and that's the area that we serve the most remote and difficult to access populations. I don't think I have the slide in here, but we know that in our population, about 70% of those deaths occurred at home. So there was a great mobilization effort. Again, this was possible because of the base that HHF has in the community, lots of education. So we, at this point, as of the end of September, have an attack rate of 2.72%, and most of those cases are referred, so about 60% of them are being referred for care, and the death rate, which has now dropped to 9.3% because we've improved coverage. There's no sex difference between who gets this, and it's not really a disease of children. Children are, we of course had cases of cholera in children, but not to the degree that we expected. And older people were more likely to die from this disease. And we think it's because adults are not used to having diarrheal disease. We teach people how to take care of their children with diarrhea. We don't teach them about taking care of themselves. I'm not going to show that. It's too busy. So it just shows that our cases kind of paralleled that big upsurge in November and December. And this slide also shows the light part is the deaths in relationship to survivors. So you see that the last December was a really hellish time, and there's no other way to describe that. I was not on the ground, but I was in constant communication, and you know, people were out every single day, Christmas included, doing everything they could to save lives. You can see how the cumulative death rate has gone down over time. So originally 18%, now 9, and the case rate has gone up. So we're focusing on prevention. Okay, I thought it was okay. We have the timers up here. I was like, maybe I don't have enough time. So we're focusing a lot on prevention. And again, a community-based program makes it possible to do that, to really mobilize people. And so it's not, building latrines is obviously important. It takes a lot longer, but clean water and hand washing are critical. And so these are young girls who are working with tippy taps, which are plastic bottles with holes in them that you can hang from places and attach soap and wash your hands. So really trying to promote that. Lots of cholera education. This is Betty up at the market. So people were educated wherever they were and whenever you could grab them. And in the lower corner, it's actually a group of voodoo priests who are being educated about what to do for cholera. So again, reaching out through non-traditional means through spiritual groups in the community. This like blows me away, Betty. I have to tell you that. So they have done sessions for 158,000 people since this epidemic started, and most of that's since December. It's just been a huge mobilization effort. And these are the kinds of groups that the education is done through. So we also have mothers clubs, not just for pregnant women, but for all women in the community. We have fathers groups, and we have youth groups because the youth wanted to have their own, and now there are children's groups. So a lot of cholera education also went on through children's groups. But all of these groups, anytime there were people together, if they were washing clothes by the river, they were given a presentation about how to prevent cholera. And the other thing is that it's important to reach out to men and women in a situation like this. Again, mostly women know how to make oral rehydration solution, but fathers don't necessarily. So now there's a whole initiative to teach men how to do that, both for the care of their children and also in terms of the cholera epidemic. Now there are lots of treatment points that are mostly around where the community health workers are. There are now 90 of these, and this is one of our community health workers down in both slides, but she's in her house with all the cholera posters and health posters up around her. Betty probably has her props with her. So she's got droppers that were used to put bleach in water, and she's got the packets they made. How many thousand? 5,000 packets of Haitian cholera rehydration solution, because the information coming out of the World Health Organization was not right and the posters were wrong in terms of what people needed to have. So they were doing all of this when they weren't out educating people. So what next? So a couple of things. We really want to focus, as I said, more on men, youth, and children in terms of ongoing education. We have been preparing people for this current rainy season so that things can be done to really mobilize as soon as possible. We really want to do more documentation at the community level. Our experience with the cholera outbreak is that none of these deaths and none of these cases, if they didn't make it to a cholera treatment center or a cholera treatment unit, were counted, which means that we have 4,000 cases that probably were not, mostly were not part of the government accounting, and a lot of deaths that were not counted. So the death rate in the Grand Anse is probably much higher than those figures I showed you earlier. So we think there needs to be sentinel sites at community level for almost any kind of outbreak of an infectious disease, just like we do it for syphilis and STDs. We're really going to be monitoring child nutrition post-earthquake and seeing what we can do and if we've been able to make the impact a little less than the last time this happened. We're tracking migration now. As we all know, we all live in a very mobile world. People are moving all the time. And so we're really trying to make more of an effort to document that so we have some idea of what the in and out of the population is, and obviously continuing with community development. Thank you.